Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dialect Coach's Corner podcast, the place where we love exploring language and the way people speak. And I'm Jerome Butler, your dialect coach, and we're down here today in Hotlanta, the ATL, Dogwood City, Atlanta, GA. And I'm so excited to have as my guest an extremely talented actor with a list of starring roles so long people are shocked to realize he's so young. You've seen him in Amistad, Dirty Pretty Things, Four Brothers, Serenity, Inside Man, American Gangster, Salt, Dancing on the Edge, Half a Yellow Sun, 12 Years a Slave, and he's currently here in Atlanta, starring in the John Hillcoat-directed film Triple Nine. I've had the pleasure of working with him on more than one occasion, and if we had a studio audience, they would be putting their hands together right now for Chiwetel Ejiofor. Welcome to the podcast, Chiwetel.
Hi. Hey. How you doing?
You know, there may be some people out there who have come to know you rather recently, but there are some of us out there who have been watching your work for almost 20 years.
Wow. When you put it like that, you make me feel so young.
You know, one of the things that I find interesting about this is talking about people's relationship to language and to the work that they do. Mm-hmm. Did the success of 12 Years a Slave have any effect on the way that you went about doing your work as an actor, the actual work?
The success of it, no. I mean, you know, you have a I suppose there's a kind of method to the way that you work and the way that you approach material. For me, there's something that I found, the way I work, I found the process many years ago. And you know, I approach all the work that I do that way. It's kind of, you know, when you're working on building a character, it's kind of like scrubbing floors. You know, you just gotta get down and do it. You know, yes. And it's just methodical work, and you know, it takes time. But it has its own. I mean, it has many rewards, and so. That's always been the process for me. It's been the same in theater and in film. And, you know, you've got to sort of deconstruct a character and then kind of build it back up and figure out what's going on and all the internal beats and sort of break it down in that way. And then you have all the external things. Obviously, the voice is important and you know, your physicality is so important. Yeah. And you know, and so you're building both the psychology and the physical side of a character at the same time.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about putting a character together and ways of working that you established a long time ago, because in the work that I've done with you, I've found that you have a tremendously strong work ethic. And can you talk a little bit about some of the ways that you establish that?
Well, it's all, you know, in a way, although the approach is the same with everything, different characters obviously demand slightly different things. There's always a different part of a character that is speaking, you know, at a kind of higher frequency than other parts. So the first thing is to isolate what that is, whether a character is very essentially in their own mind, in their own psychology, whether they express themselves through their physicality in a certain way, whether they are what their hang-ups are, what their issues are, and how they deal with them, you know, how they hide, what their faces are. What's their public face? What's their private face? Mm. How do they respond to the different people in their lives and the different people in the scripts that they come across? Obviously, how are they spoken about, and those sorts of details? I think once you start breaking down a script in that way and start understanding a character in that way, you know, there's a lot to mine and there's a lot to kind of find out. And then what you often find is that there are gaps, you know, and there are things that you'll have to kind of fill in that aren't in the script, you know, but need to be in the performance for it to kind of make full sense, sort of three-dimensional sense to you and more increasingly in film, like to an editing process, you know, and in conjunction with the director, obviously. So, you know, those are the sort of things that I kind of start to look out for and begin the process with in terms of character, in terms of breaking down character, in terms of understanding character. And then the work becomes, you know, what does this character do? And how does this character sound? And how to build those elements into it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember some of the first things that got you excited about language and using it to communicate as an actor or even as a person?
Well, I mean, you know, what brought me to this whole profession was language.
Right.
And you know, and I think, and from when I was at an impressionable age, I'm still impressionable actually, but when I was even more impressionable than I am now, and I was in my sort of early teens, I was so struck by classical language.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really what, you know, that just sort of blew my mind, that there, that in the texts of Shakespeare are these codes for living, and once you unravel the code, you know, you realize that there is something that is being passed on generationally that you can either take or leave. But when it's expressed with a kind of raw poetic energy, there's something deeply beautiful about that, and you know, and unforgettable about it. You know, I remember the very first play that I did. Well, actually, probably the second play that I ever did was Measure for Measure. And I played Angelo at high school, and there was one line in it where Angelo says, sort of repentantly, near the end of the play, spoiler alert, that he says, "When once our grace we have forgot, nothing goes right. We would, and we would not." And I just remember being completely struck by that, by the idea of not knowing who you are, not knowing what's the next move, you know, not having any sort of clarity about your own personality because you've done something that you find reprehensible or that has surprised you in your personality. So now you don't know who you are. You would and you would not. You're completely at ends. And I felt that that was such an extraordinarily elegant way of phrasing something very complicated, but obviously something that, if they're lucky, every single person experiences in their life, you know, that they completely lose their way at a certain point and they have to kind of, you know, walk through the night, you know. And I thought it really introduced me, doing that play and doing classical plays really introduced me to the nature and the skill of language as a form of expression. I remember reading Paradise Lost, you know, and having a very long debate, you know, about the introduction of Paradise Lost, where there is a line in Paradise Lost where Milton asks, you know, he says something along the lines of, "God grant me the eternal providence that I may be able to justify the ways of God to men." And that extraordinary double meaning in that, you know, that either you're explaining to men why God does what he does, justify the ways of God to men, you know, or you're doing something very different. You are justifying how you're trying to explain men and God within the same.
Yes.
You know, you're saying, "God grant me the eternal providence that I may be able to justify the ways of God to men," you know, and I feel like, and I remember thinking and having this big debate about which one of those two things Milton is saying, that you're trying to talk to men about God, about why God does what he does, the ways of God, you know. That's one meaning. The second meaning is you are talking about the way God treats men. So you are to justify the ways of God to men, you know, which is a completely different reading of it. That in one sense you are looking at a very benevolent God, in the first sense, you know, even though you're trying to justify both things, but one of them is very benevolent. You are saying, "God grant me the eternal providence that I may justify the ways of God to men."
Yes.
You know, that I will let all men see how God operates. And on the other level, "God grant me eternal providence that I may justify the ways of God to men." That this God is not is a punishing God.
Yes.
You need,
and a confusing God at,
yeah,
at some point.
Yeah, and you need God's help in order to explain why he treats men in this way.
Yes.
You know, and based on the two different interpretations of that, you have a completely different reading of Paradise Lost and the nature with which Milton is coming in to write this epic poem and what he is actually saying about the struggles of Beelzebub and the devils who fall nine times the length that measures day and night to ordinary men, you know. And it's so it completely reveals a completely different thing about the poem. And
well, it's a choice which side you're going to fall down on. Isn't that one of the wonderful things about poetry, that you have a poem and a poem grows inside you over time. It burnishes over time. It means something at one point, and then later on, you, my goodness.
Yeah. I mean, I can never get over, you know, say the love song of J.R. Prufrock, you know, because that's something that I, as a poem, I've come back and forth to in my life. And every time I reapproach it, it means something completely different. But it just means something much deeper, you know. I'm amazed that T.S. Eliot was so young when he wrote it, you know, because it is something that just seems so full of a kind of growing acceptance of age and life and wisdom, mm-hmm. and all of the kind of contradictions that you encounter. But I think that's when it's great, you know, is when it constantly changes and morphs and sways with you.
Yeah. And also has the ability to mean many things to many people.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in many different ways and walks of life.
Yeah.
Times of life.
Yeah. You know, that's my fascination with language. And, you know, I mean, you know, by way of example, again, I mean, you know, we've spoken about this before, that there's a sequence in Macbeth, you know, which became and is to me... it just became seminal in my understanding of language. You know, it just became sort of one of the most important things that ever happened to me in terms of being an actor. And it's a sequence in Macbeth. It's very early in Macbeth, you know, where Macbeth and Banquo have sort of finished these major wars, have killed everybody, you know, the Norwegians, and destroyed the battles of the armies that were fighting Scotland, and they return to King Duncan, and there's this sort of huge fanfare about that, and Duncan himself is completely beside himself with excitement to see Macbeth and to lavish praise on him. What Duncan doesn't know, but what we as the audience know, is that in the meantime, on the way back, Macbeth has encountered these three witches, and they have told him, amongst other things, that he will be king. So he comes back, and Duncan says something. He says, more is thy due than more than all can pay. You know, in substance, you're saying, you know, none of us here can give you the riches and the rewards you deserve for what you've done.
Mm.
And Macbeth responds, the service and the loyalty I owe in doing it pays itself. Your Highness's part is to receive our duties, and our duties are to your throne and state, your children and servants who do but what they should by doing everything safe towards your love and honor. And to me, that's one of those classic Shakespearean moments which, before I was really deeply involved in Shakespeare, always struck me as kind of shoe leather, you know, just getting you from one place to another. I mean, what is Macbeth talking about? Why does he need to respond in this way? And it's like eight lines or something, you know. And what does he say? You know, nothing. He said, you know, the guy says to him, listen, we're really happy to have you back. And he says, the service and the loyalty I owe in doing it pays itself. Your Highness's part is to receive our duties, and our duties are to your throne and state, your children and servants who do but what they should by doing everything safe toward your love and honor. And I sat there, you know, and felt that kind of Shakespearean language, you know, is sort of meaningless for years, you know, in a way, when I was sort of starting to study Shakespeare and sort of reading past all that stuff. And now, of course, I have a very, very, very strong alarm bell whenever I have that feeling. Because what I've come to learn about the language and what I've come to learn about Shakespeare is that whenever you get that feeling, go back. Go back, because actually what you might be missing is a seminal part of the text, a seminal part of the story, something that might reveal the whole project in a completely different light.
Yes.
And that, of course, is what those eight lines are, you know, and you go back into it and you realize that there's something else going on entirely. Duncan says, "More is thy due and more than all can pay." And it is a full stop. There is no need to respond. The applause can go. Macbeth can bask in the light of it. Absolutely great. Instead, he does something different. He says, "The service and the loyalty I owe in doing it pays itself." And maybe that seems innocuous to most people, but it's not really. He's explaining something to the king. He's explaining something about his loyalty and his sense of himself. Okay, well, we can let that pass. That's fine. But then he goes on to say, "Your Highness's part." Wow. This man is telling the king what the king should do? "Your Highness's part is to receive our duties." Well, okay, there's another pause there. Now, you could at this point say, "Listen, that was a little rude, but I'm going to let it slide." But he goes on. "And our duties are to your throne and state, your children and servants." Okay, now he's bringing it back. He's telling the king exactly who owes him loyalty, and he's doing it in a way that he doesn't necessarily need to speak at this volume, at this pitch to the king, but maybe he's saying something positive, that we all love you and it's all good. But he ends it by saying, "Which do but what they should, by doing everything safe toward your love and honor." So by the end of this moment, you realize something else. Macbeth is making a political speech. For the first time in his life, he is taking a moment to address the crowd, to address the king, in a tone that equates to or is consistent with leadership. He is attempting in this moment to dominate the king. In these eight lines, Macbeth is showing that he not only believes the witches, but he is going to act upon it. He is going to attempt to be king. And it is revealed through eight lines of dialogue that are very easy to skip by, that to me always appeared previously to be shoe leather, right, until upon analysis, they are the crucial moment of change in the first half of the play. "The service and the loyalty I owe in doing it pays itself. Your Highness's part is to receive our duties, and our duties are to your throne and state, your children and servants, who do but what they should, by doing everything safe toward your love and honor."
So suddenly he's playing high status. He becomes
a high status player. This is a soldier who has no right to speak this way in front
yes.
of the king.
Yes, he's breaking protocol.
And is not invited to speak this way in front of the king. It is a total breach of all protocol and an absolute stab for another place.
Very, very compelling analysis and a wonderful insight into the story. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Chiwetel Ejiofor.